Welcome, everyone, to episode 226 of the NBA podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and I am dead inside thanks to Kawhi Leonard, but the show must go on. So we are going to talk today. We're going to do a conference finals preview, and we are also going to talk about the Lakers coaching search now that it has finally reached its merciful conclusion. Before we get to all of that, a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter at the NBA pod. In our bio, you can find our Twitter handles, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes, so please subscribe. Download, leave some five-star reviews, and we're now being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter, at Spreaker. Joining me today is not my very stable genius of a co-host, Morten Jensen. He's got a busy week at work, so we're bringing in some pinch hitters, and since we're talking Lakers, I figured there was no one better to bring in than the host of Locked On Lakers, Anthony Irwin. How's it going, man?
I don't know if there's no one better. I appreciate the sentiment altogether. Things are going, Brian. Things are going.
I just feel like I troll you so much on Twitter. Like, I troll you more than other Lakers fans. I'm not really sure why I do that, but this is my way of repaying you by bringing you on and saying I'm sorry, and we can talk all things Lakers in a little bit. But since the conference finals are now set, I figure we'll start there. And let's start with the Warriors-Blazers series, which tips off Tuesday night. One of the big storylines, of course, is Kevin Durant is still out. Ramona Shelburne of ESPN reported he will be out for at least game one and likely game two as well. There was also a report that DeMarcus Cousins might be back for this series, but Steve Kerr kind of pumped the brakes on that today. He said basically KD and Cousins aren't even doing on-court work, so it sounds like at least for the first two games in Oracle, we have to expect no KD, no Cousins. So, Anthony, the first question is, are you giving the Blazers any chance in this series, even if KD and Cousins are out?
No, probably not. And I think that, so I don't want this to come off as me saying, like, I'm not going to go so full NBA hipster to say that the Warriors are better without Kevin Durant. But I do think, though, that so if Steph Curry is leading the offense, that forces Dame Lillard or CJ McCollum, whoever is guarding him in those situations, to focus a lot more on defense. And I think that actually makes the matchup a little bit more complicated for Portland. And then whenever Kevin Durant comes in, Curry becomes, you know, he plays a smaller role in the offense, and therefore Dame and or CJ McCollum, whoever is guarding them, can relax just a little bit more in that respect. It's not going to be so much of Steph on the ball, I don't think. So it's an interesting series. I'm trying to find reasons to believe that it might go longer than like five games, but it's really hard for me not to think that the Warriors just handle business here.
Yeah, I'm trying to talk myself into that too. Like, I'm almost to the point where I could see Warriors in six, assuming KD and Cousins are out through like four games. I think if the Blazers don't win one of these first two at Oracle, it's going to be over in five, most likely.
Yeah.
But I do think there is, I mean, we saw them in game six against the Rockets without KD, without Cousins. They still take care of business. They, you know, slam the door on the Rockets with Steph having a 33-point half, because of course he did. But, you know, I do think there's something to the fear that they really just don't have that many guys they can trust. And KD has been, you know, their steadiest presence throughout the playoffs. Mm-hmm. He's the guy. And even Draymond said this after the game. He's like, When KD's there, we can get lazy because we just pass KD the ball. We know he's going to score.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, to your point about, you know, the NBA hipster take that, you know, they're better without Kevin Durant, I don't think that's true. I think their offense operates differently. And when Steph gets cooking like he did in the second half of game six, then they look like the unstoppable death machine they were from a couple of years ago. But I also don't think you can necessarily count on Andre Iguodala to have 5 3-pointers in, you know, every game. You definitely can't count on that.
Yeah.
So I can at least talk myself into the Blazers stealing one of these first two, and then they go home. I feel like if they do, KD probably rushes back a little more quickly than he otherwise would. If they're up 2-0, I don't think he comes back before game five. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I lean Warriors regardless here. And I think part of my concern is I just think matchup-wise, if you're the Warriors, I think you can just say, all right, Clay and Iggy are going on Dame and CJ. We're going to ignore Mo Harkless. We're going to ignore Al-Farouq Aminu. Cantor is bigger than, you know, if we're going small ball, he's bigger than Draymond. He might beat us up on the offensive glass, but I don't know that you have enough reliable sources of offense if you're the Blazers, if Dame and CJ are really struggling. Mm-hmm. The good thing is Rodney Hood, he's day-to-day. He suffered what looked to be a potentially serious knee injury in Game 7 against the Nuggets, but we don't know what his status is for Game 1 and beyond. So how do you think the Blazers can generate offense in this series if Dame and CJ are struggling?
Right?
That's where I keep, yeah, where I keep coming to.
Is it Collins time? Like, are we going with the CW group of Collins, Myers, Leonard, and I don't know, whoever? It's, look, I don't mean to minimize what the Blazers have done to get here. You know, they took care of business against OKC in ways that I don't think very many people would have predicted. I definitely bet, or not bet, but I would have bet against them in Denver in a Game 7. And winning a Game 7 on the road is very impressive stuff, right? Getting here, honestly, at this point they're playing with house money. Golden State, they have two reasons to me beyond the normal stuff, because we know the normal stuff doesn't really get the Warriors going. You know, the usual game in, game out reasons to push yourself and stuff like that, that doesn't really get them going at this point of their dynasty. But they do have reasons, though, to really come out and send a message and take care of business here. And one is, I think a lot of the Warriors players have listened to the amount of stuff that has been talked about with KD and how he is their best overall player and all of this stuff. And I, you know, Steph went so far as to say, I don't know if it was Steph or Kerr, I think it was Steph, who said that, like, when Durant went down, there were smiles in the locker room. Mm-hmm. Not like not ill-tempered smiles like, aha, you know, nothing like that. I just think they had this challenge and they've heard all this noise now for ever since Durant showed up, and they want that opportunity to send a message. And then the other thing too is, after they get through Portland, Toronto is really freaking good. Milwaukee is really freaking good, and they're going to need to be as rested as they can possibly be for that series. So they have, there's more incentive here for them to come out and take care of business quickly than there would be perhaps otherwise. And I think all of that stuff comes together, and you know, as much as I really respect what the Blazers did this year, it's hard for me to feel like or find any reason to think that they're going to do anything other than maybe take a game here.
Yeah. I'm with you. I mean, I think it's as you said, it's no disrespect to the Blazers. It's really a testament to them to staying the course with this core. You know, getting swept in the first round last year was demoralizing, and they very easily could have blown up this team, traded CJ, considering trading Dame. Instead, they didn't. They came back. Nurkic got hurt. That could have ended their season. Instead, Cantor, I mean, that guy's earned himself a lot of money on this playoff run. Mm-hmm. Rodney Hood's been great. Seth Curry's been great off the bench. Even Evan Turner comes out in Game 7 against the Nuggets and really helps swing that game. Like, it's been a team-wide effort from the Blazers, but the problem is the playoffs are just about matchups. And yeah. I just don't see... You could at least find matchups in these first two series that Portland could exploit. Like, Hood in the Nuggets series was phenomenal all series. But the Warriors are just so uniquely equipped to give this team trouble, because, you know, they do rely a lot on Dame and CJ to create offense. They can get something from Cantor and Hood off the bench, and you'll get a couple points from Aminu and Harkless. But if one of Dame or CJ isn't cooking, you're in trouble. And Clay and Iggy are both just such great defenders. And then if KD comes back later in the series, Aminu will give them trouble. But then you've still got Steph and Clay to worry about.
Yeah.
Like, it just seems like there are too many, like, you'll plug one hole if you're Portland and another's going to spring up, and you're just not going to keep all the holes plugged at one time.
Yeah. I mean, we knew going into the Rockets-Warrior series that was probably the Western Conference Finals. Yeah. You know, and you know, unfortunately, it took place around too early, but that's because of the way both teams played over the course of the regular season. And again, like, if you're Portland, if you're a Blazers fan, like, just getting here is enough. Like, now, would you prefer to win? Obviously, yes. But realistically speaking, just getting here, given everything that this team has gone through this year, especially in regards to Nurkic, you just take it. And you come into next year with more momentum than I think you ever could have hoped for, given how the season ended and given Nurkic's injury in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Zach Collins, you mentioned him before, but he was one of the breakout stars of that Nuggets series.
Yeah.
And he's the one guy where I have seen people, some Portland people on Twitter, wondering, like, well, maybe we start Zach Collins at the four instead of Aminu. And to me, it's like, well, maybe you should start Zach Collins at the five, because I feel like Cantor is just going to get... This is the one series, you know, Cantor against OKC is fine because you don't have to worry about him against Steven Adams. Like, Steven Adams is in the stretch five.
Yeah.
When they involved him and Russ in pick and rolls, Cantor was like, all right, I'm just going to drop back and let Russ shoot mid-range jumpers all game. That's cool. This is the one where if you're in a Steph Dre pick and roll, we saw it with Clint Capela last series. Clint Capela is a great defensive player, but he was useless in that series. And so
This
is the one where I feel like Cantor's could be the glass slipper might come back off in this series, and we see his weaknesses exposed defensively. So Collins maybe at the five could help stymie a little bit of that, and then you bring Cantor off the bench and just beat the hell out of him on offensive rebounds in that second unit. But again, it's just like, I don't see an obvious move. Like, we'll talk about Bucks Raptors in a second, and I think both of those teams present matchup challenges for each other, but I think you can at least find some counters here. Portland, it's like, I feel like you're drawing dead from the start, basically.
Yeah, the big question whenever Cantor is in is, will he be committed to the game plan enough, disciplined enough to, when Draymond is on that short roll, is he going to be disciplined enough to back off and force Draymond to shoot that floater in the key, right?
Yeah.
If he isn't, they're screwed, right?
Yeah, right.
But if he is and he can punish them on the other end of the court with some offensive rebounding, I know one of the stats that was really loud in that Houston series was whichever team out-rebounded the other had a, I think they either went undefeated or maybe only lost one game all through those six games. So, you know, if Cantor's able to kind of impose his will on the boards to the point where, you know, you offset your liability on defense, okay, maybe. All right, I can maybe roll with it. And maybe if CJ or if Dame get Iggy or Clay into foul trouble one of those games, all right, maybe, especially early, you know, before KD comes back, all right, maybe I could see something going on there. And I think that'll be the key to winning, you know, one game. I just don't see that being a repetitive, something you can go to the well to repeatedly and hope for all of those things to work out enough over the course of a seven game series to really push Golden State.
Yeah, I'm right with you. So, do you have an official amount of games prediction? It's clear we're both going Warriors here, but Warriors in how many?
I'm saying five. I want nothing more than to be wrong here and get a more entertaining series than I'm kind of envisioning. But you know, it's just this matchup is really tough. It's tough for any team, but especially a team that is so reliant on lead guards as Portland is. There's just so many ways that the Warriors can attack Dame and CJ here, and that makes me really nervous.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think I'm, like, so torn between five and six, and it's just, it's 100% due to the, I just don't know when KD is coming back.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to say six, even though I really believe five, but I'm a coward, and I'm going to give, I've slept on Portland for so long that I owe them this for once to overcredit them instead of undercredit them.
That's absolutely fair, and again, it just goes back to the point that we've made here now a couple times is, yes, it sounds like we are writing them off, but I am not by any means whatsoever writing off the accomplishment that was getting here. I think that's that's the point to make more heavily than whatever happens in this series.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, this is a house money series by far. Yeah. This is like a phenomenal season for Portland.
They're playing blackjack with the casino's money. They can double down on queens if you want. You could split queens. You could do all the dumb stuff that pisses off the rest of the table. But at this point, you know, you got to acknowledge like the talent gap between these two teams, and not just the talent gap, but like. I would imagine if you were to try to divvy up the amount of talent across Portland's team, it's what, like 75% is in their backcourt, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And so, you know, if 75% of your talent is in your backcourt, and the opposing backcourt is Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, that's right. That's a daunting task.
Yeah. I just hope we get some fireworks. I want like one 50-point Dame game versus like Steph cooking one game. I think the Warriors will be locked in defensively, but I want them to fall asleep one game and just let Dame and CJ go off.
Yeah, I could definitely. I mean, it is the kind of matchup that I could see. Like if KD was still healthy, I think there's a good chance they fall asleep and they take Portland a little too lightly in one of the first two early games. Mm-hmm. I just think this group. Minus KD is so hungry to continue to prove a point that you know, it's not necessarily that they want to tell everybody, oh, we don't need KD. It's more of a look, we've heard all of this criticism over the last 3 years or whatever, and we want to continue to show that no, we were still a great team when we added him.
Right. And like for all we know, he's gone in 2 months and we could prove that we will be right in this mix next year even without him.
Yeah. This playoffs has really, or KD's injury has really shown like how desperately the league needs him go to New York.
Oh, for sure.
Right? Yeah. Like the league is so much more interesting with this version of the Warriors.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you at least I think 10 teams next year could talk themselves into being legit title contenders if KD is not on the Warriors.
Yeah.
Depending on what happens in free agency, but like assuming the big name guys go where they've rumored to be going. Mm-hmm. This could be an explosive offseason. Like the most fun regular season we've had next year could be the most fun regular season we've had since the mid 2010s.
Yep. Yeah, since before KD went to Oakland.
Yeah. So let's go to the other series now, and this one's just going to hurt to talk about, but I'm gonna power through it.
We'll go Bucks Raptors. I can't believe you're not recording this with a beer, dude. It's crazy to me.
that was last night. And then the worst part was I watched that shot, and then like we had friends over watching the game because we were gonna like watch Game of Thrones right afterward, and I'm like, well, this will be a nice palate cleanser.
Oh God.
And then I was like, I don't know which one I'm more disappointed in. I think Game of Thrones.
That's a tough night of TV viewing.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, my wife, we were going to sleep. She's like, I can't believe I just wasted 4 hours of my life like that. Like,
for getting those 4 hours back.
I know. Like, you have a fair point. But yeah, so Bucks Raptors. I think it's reductive to boil it down to this, but I think this is where you have to start with the analysis because it's Giannis versus Kawhi. Mm-hmm. So the question is, how do you stop Giannis and how do you stop Kawhi? So let's start with the Giannis side. If you're the Raptors, how do you stop Giannis? Or do you do what the Sixers did in the regular season and say, screw it, we're not going to stop Giannis. Let him get 50. We're just going to play good defense on all of these other three-point shooters.
I think that's kind of – either way is tough. One thing that you know, heading into the playoffs – a lot of people kind of, I wouldn't say wrote off Milwaukee, but definitely undersold how good they were. And I think that has a lot to do with, you know, teams that kind of manipulate the math of basketball. The first time they get into a playoffs situation, people want to see them prove this first, right? Actually show me that you're as good as you were in the regular season. And I think, you know, they go out and they sweep Detroit. Now, granted, Detroit didn't, you know, Blake Griffin either wasn't around, or if he was around, he was kind of hobbled, right? Mm-hmm. But they take care of business against Detroit. They have that sticker shop shock kind of game against Boston in game one, where they were like, oh, wow, you're a lot better than Detroit was, right?
Right, right. oh, it's a real basketball team.
Yeah, right. And but once they kind of calmed down and let the game, you know, return to coming to them in the ways that it did in the regular season, we saw them dominate, right? Win mm-hmm. four straight games against Boston. And I think that is a nice little palate cleanser. That was not palate cleanser, but a great way to prepare for this Toronto team that, you know, is better than Boston, objectively mm-hmm. speaking. But presents different things that are going to test different aspects of Milwaukee. But at the end of the day, the math has shown itself to be correct with Milwaukee. And I think that's going to be really hard for Toronto to overcome. So if you're fighting against math, then you take away the thing that is the more efficient math equation. And in this case, the more efficient math equation is taking away three-point shooters and forcing Giannis to beat you with a bunch of two-point shots and hope you can take care of business that way. I just, you know, you pick your poison in that case. And even still, I think Giannis is good enough to make that work to the way that Milwaukee is hoping to.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's a challenge because they don't – I mean, there's – not really anyone in the league that can match up with Giannis in terms of physicality, but you know, at least Al Horford gave him a little bit of trouble, especially in that game one. And the Raptors, you know, they have Kawhi, who is an all-world defender, but he's giving up at least 3 inches on Giannis, and
yeah,
you know, it's still a tough matchup just because of that, I think.
And he can't get into foul trouble. They cannot afford that.
Right. So I think he's probably going on Middleton to start the series. And then I guess you probably start Siakam on Giannis. And then, you know, Marc Gasol is there in the middle to ideally serve as that second line of defense. The problem mm-hmm. is, as you're saying, Brook Lopez is a great 3-point shooter. So you can't play drop coverage on him because yeah. he's just going to pick you apart. But, you know, it's just going to be Giannis driving kicks right to Brook Lopez. So mm-hmm. I think that's definitely the challenge for the Raptors. But on the other end, it's how do you stop Kawhi? Because, yeah. you know, Chris Middleton is a great defender as well, but he's giving up size to Kawhi. Like, if Jimmy Butler struggled to stop Kawhi Leonard, Chris Middleton is likely also going to struggle to stop Kawhi Leonard.
Mm-hmm.
If you put Giannis on him, it's the same deal as you said. You can't risk putting Giannis in foul trouble, too. So yeah. it's like both of these teams have these unique dominant superstars where there's no easy, oh, we'll just put this guy on him and this will fix everything. It's like both of these teams present very unique matchup challenges to each other.
I kind of wish this series was being played in the 90s though.
Right? So there are no threes.
Well, not just from the standpoint of like not having threes, but more from the standpoint of like I wish Giannis and Kawhi would just guard each other for seven games.
Oh yeah.
You know, like teams yeah. nowadays are smart enough to say like, no, that's probably not the smartest thing to do here. But wouldn't that be so much fun? Just yeah. haymaker after haymaker. Just like the same kind of thing applies in the Golden State and Portland series, right? Wouldn't it be so much fun if both teams were so dumb as to just have Steph and Dame go at each other? It would be incredible. It would be so great. but you know, alas, here we are, and teams have figured out that no, you kind of want to save legs and not risk foul trouble with these superstars who would go up against each other. But we are still going to have moments late in the game where they go mano a mano kind of thing, and those. Mm-hmm. Like, this series, I think, is going to offer up those throwback moments in ways that we haven't really seen in a little while. Like, we kind of saw it with Durant and LeBron. It's just that the talent around LeBron was so far behind where Kevin Durant was that it was hard to even get that kind of classic matchup kind of situation. This is one where both teams are I think, really good. The supporting cast on both these teams is really good, and it's going to open things up for both these guys to really go at each other in close games in those last, like, 5 minutes, and it's going to be incredible. I don't know if I've looked forward to a series as much as I'm looking forward to Toronto and Milwaukee.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they were the two best teams in the East the entire season. Like, both of these teams deserve to be here, and we don't know what's going to happen with Kawhi this summer. The Bucks also have a number of important free agents, including Middleton. So, like, mm-hmm. for all we know, I mean, yeah, they could, both teams could retain everyone, and maybe this is the Eastern Conference Finals for the next 3 years, but for all we know, some of these guys are going west, and we're never going to get to see this again unless it's in the finals. So I'm with you. I mean, if it wasn't going to be the Sixers in here, this is the series I always wanted to see. Also, because I hate Boston, and it makes me very happy that they imploded in the second round.
They got boat raced. I'm with you on that hate.
Gee, I'm shocked.
The other thing, too, that I think is going to warrant a ton of attention here is which point guard outplays the other one.
Yeah.
Kyle Lowry and Eric Bledsoe, they really, I think, they're kind of the barometer of what the team is capable of, as much as any other player on their respective teams. If Kyle Lowry and Eric Bledsoe, if one of those guys just really wins the matchup one way or the other, I think that could really swing the series in whichever team benefits from that, the direction that goes. It's really going to be interesting to watch because it's you know, Lowry, we all know about his playoff struggles, right? Mm-hmm. We know how that has gone for the majority of the time. The nice thing that I think Nick Nurse has figured out a way to do, and it's actually one of the things that Luke Walton was doing with Lonzo Ball, was he just has Lowry focusing on the small things, set a bunch of screens for people, get out there and dive for loose balls, take charges, stuff like that, that are completely within his control, right? Because if he focuses on things that aren't necessarily in his control, that hasn't gone very well for him in the playoffs. And I think if he sticks to doing that and is able to do enough of that to offset or be a larger impact than Eric Bledsoe, that really helps Toronto's chances.
Yeah, I mean, the supporting cast thing in general, the thing I was most surprised by in Sixers-Raptors is coming into that series, you figure the Raptors bench just has such an edge on the Sixers, and that wasn't the case in practice, in part because Brett Brown really narrowed down his rotation after a while and was really only running seven guys out there. But the Raptors didn't really get much of anything out of anyone other than Serge Ibaka. Like, Fred VanVleet was terrible in that series. Yeah. Norm Powell was invisible. Pat McCaw was invisible. Not having OG because he's, you know, he went out with the appendectomy, and I don't know what his status is for if he's going to come back at all in the Eastern Conference Finals. I hope so because he's an important part of that team, but yeah, it's which of these guys comes through? Can Kyle Lowry come through with a 15-point game? Is Marc Gasol still going to be? He's really hesitant to shoot, and if especially if the Bucks play the drop coverage they did throughout most of the season, you can't do that against Marc Gasol. Marc Gasol can hit open threes. Is he going to be willing to take those when they swing the ball, or is he going to hunt for a higher percentage shot? You know, Serge Ibaka, I think I saw he was a plus 22. In game seven, like, which there are no words to describe how unexpected that was. But, you know, that's a big thing. If you get a big game out of Serge Ibaka or out of Nico Mirotic, Malcolm Brogdon came back at the end of the Celtics series. I would assume they're going to keep him coming off the bench to start, but maybe he sees some minutes defensively on Kawhi as well, or maybe can he hit a couple big threes? Like, I said at the start of this segment, it is too reductive to just boil it down to Giannis and Kawhi because the supporting cast are going to play just as much of a role in deciding who wins this. And having seen how much Toronto's supporting cast struggled with assertiveness, I think it's fair to say, I lean Milwaukee for that reason more so than I think Giannis is going to destroy Kawhi. I have a little bit more faith in Milwaukee's supporting cast. But that said, like, if Kawhi is guarding Middleton, he's gone.
Yeah. Those clamps are put down. The way I would kind of put it is, as you go deeper into the playoffs, the deeper benches tend to start mattering less, right? Mm-hmm. But the margins start to matter more, right? Yeah. So I think in aggregate, the margins, because these teams are so closely matched, generally speaking, like Portland and Golden State doesn't really qualify for this just because Golden State is so much better than Portland just in general. But in a series like this where the teams are so evenly matched, those aspects of the game that usually go overlooked, those small marginal victories here and there become all the more highlighted because of how even Kawhi and Giannis are likely to play each other, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's interesting in this one whether or not Gasol shows a little bit more openness to you know, really forcing his will on a series. Like he's paid like a player who should be forcing his will on the series, right? Like they gave up way too much for him to just be some tentative role player kind of player. He needs to step up and show why they made that move in the first place. And if he doesn't, you know, that's going to be a what if that's going to, you know, kind of sit in Toronto Raptor fans' heads for a little while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if nothing else, he gives great hugs at the end of series.
As to the wrong team, though.
Right, that's true. Well, maybe if the Raptors lose, it'll give a great hug to Kawhi, and Kawhi will resign because he's got a great hugger. I don't know. But no, I mean, it's a totally fair point. It's like they definitely need one of Lowry, Green, Gasol, Ibaka. I mean, probably even more than that, but they need those guys to really... It can't just be the Kawhi show. It was the Kawhi show for too much against Philly, and they got away with it. You know, in part because Embiid, if he's not sick for three games in that series, like, if Embiid's healthy in game four, or, like, not on death's door with meningitis or whatever the hell he had, the Sixers probably win that game, and then they probably close it out in six. Like, that series was a one-possession game seven. Like, it was razor thin.
Yeah.
And as you said, the Bucks are better than the Sixers. They have arguably the best player in the East in Giannis. They've had an entire season to develop chemistry. They made a move at the trade deadline, much like Philly and Toronto, but adding Nico was like the most minor of the three. You didn't have to tear up your whole offense or your whole defense to bring in Nico Mirotic, whereas Philly and Toronto just didn't have that much time with their new additions. So the one thing I have seen circulating on Twitter, at least a little bit today, is the thought that, you know, Toronto got battle tested against a Philly team that put up a really good fight, whereas, you know, Boston beats Milwaukee in game one and then just kind of folded for the next four games. You're not going to get that luxury from Toronto. Do you put any stock into that, thinking that, like, that gives Toronto an advantage because they've been, you know, they are more tested through adversity in these playoffs than Milwaukee is so far?
Well, it's the test versus rest theory, right? Like, it's on one hand, yes, there is something to be gained from, you know, we saw it in hockey where Tampa Bay just got boat raced out of the playoffs because they hadn't had to care about a game in a month. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think in situations like that where it's so long that you don't have to push yourself, it matters a little bit more. I just think, generally speaking, I would want the more rested team, especially given how hard Giannis has to play to make that car go. You know, he's your engine, and if you can give your engine a little bit more rest here and there, heading into a series, I think I would probably put a little bit more stock in having a fresher team than a team coming off of such a tough victory over Philly. But it's close, you know, and it's the kind of thing, it's how a lot of this series goes, right? Where there are arguments to be made on both sides of this ball. It makes this series really interesting, really fascinating, because while you might want to say, yeah, Toronto has a great supporting cast, they've had a great supporting cast all year, they have a nice bench that they can look at, and then you can look at the other side and you can say, well, Milwaukee also doesn't have, you know, George Hill basically ended Boston's season, right? So,
yep.
So there are aspects on both sides here that you can point to. It's really hard to find out and out advantages in this series, and it makes it for, like I said, one of the more fascinating series that we've had in a little while.
Yeah, I think the crappy thing is I think the ratings for the series are going to suck, just because I don't think casual fans, it's not. Like, the marketability for Giannis and Kawhi to hardcore fans is totally there. And, like, I'm going to watch every game of this series, but I think it's like LeBron, Steph, Harden. I honestly think the NBA, if you're rooting for ratings, should have been rooting for the Sixers to make it through, because I think you can market Embiid versus Giannis more. But that's neither here nor there. I'm not going to keep dwelling on this. So this one, I genuinely don't know who you're going to predict. We could tell from the tenor of our conversation in the West it was going to be the Warriors, but What's your prediction in this series?
I think home court here is a big one. Mm-hmm. I think that's the big factor here with how large a role players are going to play in this series, having that home court advantage. Just like I said, the depth of a bench is minimalized as you go deeper into the playoffs, but those margins become a lot more important. And I think in this case, Milwaukee having home court for the benefit of their role players, giving them the edge in that margin is going to be pretty big. So I think that's what I'll go Milwaukee in seven.
I like it. Yeah, I am so torn here. I want to say, like, my gut says Bucks in six, but then my head says Bucks in seven or Raptors in seven. Like, I hope it goes seven just because I think this series is going to be great. But I also want Kawhi to get the hell out of this conference, so I want the Bucks to win. Like, really, I want the Bucks to sweep and, like, all of the Raptors to just be terrible except for Kawhi, who, like, puts up 50 and is like, oh, screw this team. I'm going to the Clippers.
Well, not the Clippers. I would prefer he says screw this team and signs up for the hell sphere that that is the Lakers.
That's a perfect transition then, because we need to address the hell sphere that is the Lakers. Because Mort and I, as I was telling you before we started, we've basically been ignoring your team throughout the playoffs because there's been actual basketball. But we did do a whole episode on the Magic Johnson debacle. We briefly mentioned the Ty Lue thing, but then we just referenced it in passing. So let's start there, because there were reports basically that they were, like, in deep negotiations with Ty Lue to become their next head coach after Monty Williams took the Suns' job. Ty Lue, they were trying to make it like he wasn't the second choice, or maybe he wasn't, I don't know. But then there was a hang up over the number of years they were offering him. They offered him a 3-year deal. He wanted 5. And they were trying to impose Jason Kidd as an assistant coach on his bench. So then that whole thing, then he's just like, nah, screw this. I'm out. I don't need this. So yeah. What were your thoughts when the Ty Lue stuff fell through?
Oh, come on. So, all right, the show literally, so Locked On Lakers runs daily, Monday through Friday, right? Uh-huh. And then twice a week, Pete and I, Laker Film Room and I, he's on the show, and he and I go back and forth. The show literally before the Ty Lue stuff went down, Pete and I were talking, and it looked like they were going to hire Ty Lue, and it made a lot of sense. It was the right move and all these things. And I went so far as to say, this is me happy. So I went so far as to welcome happiness, to welcome the return of hope. And lo and behold, you know, we know what would happen next. Look, here's the thing. Rob Pelinka was hired. He was hired as general manager, and in large part the thinking was, well, he's a great negotiator, right? He's a great negotiator. He's going to win us a lot of these marginal battles, and maybe we'll save a million here and there. Unfortunately, to this point, it's been the opposite, right? He overpaid Rajon Rondo. He overpaid Lance Stephenson. He overpaid Michael Beasley even. He overpaid to get rid of Michael Beasley. The Reggie Bullock trade was about right. And the JaVale signing was fine at a veterans minimum deal, right? But like in a lot of these situations, he's overpaid. And I think he really thought that he had Ty Lue over a barrel. But he, like, seemed to forget, oh, yeah, that's right, Dan Gilbert still owes him, like, $10 million. And so, like, unemployment was a perfectly feasible situation for Ty Lue. And so he tries to strong-arm Lue into a 3-year deal and also tries to force Jason Kidd on him. Lue, I think, was even open to Jason Kidd. The reports after the fact said that, like, yeah, he obviously would have preferred to be able to pick his entire staff, but I guess he could deal with Kidd. But at the end of the day, you know, the Cleveland Cavaliers, Ty Lue's last employer, just gave a 5-year deal to a coach who's coming out of college. Right.
Right.
Luke Walton, right. The Lakers, the guy who preceded Ty, or would have preceded Ty Lue, just got a 5-year deal in Sacramento. Like five years, at least 4 years. Like, that's the thing that really annoyed me here, was that, like, the Lakers were like, it's either 5 or it's not going to be five, it's going to be three. And I'm thinking there's a number right there in between the two. Right. Like four right. is sitting right there, guys. And they were just, right. You know, Pelinka just overplayed his stance on negotiating here. And it led to a situation now where, like, if you're LeBron, you legitimately really respect Ty Lue, right? And this guy helped you win a title. This guy helped you bring a title to your hometown. I would imagine LeBron really holds Lou in really high regard. We know he does, reportedly speaking. And the Lakers basically embarrassed him publicly with the offers that they were making. And, like, that's the other thing. The three-year, $18 million offer that they made was the second one. What was the first?
Right. Like, they upped their offer to get there. My whole question is, like, why are you being cheap here? You're the Lakers. Like, you're one of the wealthiest brands, at least in terms of brands. I don't know, you know, Bust family financials. I have no idea what's going on there. But, like, you are one of the most wealthy, prestigious brands in all of sports, not just basketball, all of sports. Like, you look at the Forbes annual valuations, the Lakers are always toward the top. Why are you being cheap with a coach that... That doesn't even count against the salary cap.
Right.
Like, if I'm one of those teams, if I'm the Knicks or the Lakers, I'm spending so much money on the ancillary stuff that doesn't count Absolutely. Against the cap. Because why not?
Yeah. Go get the best analytics department. Go get the best medical staff. Go get the best assistant coaching staff. Go get the best shooting coach that's out there. Go get the best player development guy that's out there. Go get, you know, like if you were honestly running the Lakers and you had all of that revenue to be able to work with, and you could throw, like, hell, $12 million a year at Greg Popovich, that's KCP's contract, right?
Right.
Like, that's like nothing. That's a drop in the bucket. And what I think is really short-sighted, so short-sighted, by the way, that you have to question whether or not the buses are just broke. But the thing that is so short-sighted here is these are investments in your team that would be paid back by the caliber of the basketball that you would throw out there as a result of said investment, right? This is if you invest fully in your team, you get all the best medical staff so that LeBron James is on the court more often than he was last year. You get an analytics department that surrounds him with – the type of talent and the type of players and the type of fit that makes it so that the situation is optimized for him, that makes that viewing experience all the better. Like, all of these things pay back into the organization in the ways that any other investment would. But yeah, they cheapskated out here, and it's fair, I think, because they haven't they still have yet to say anything since Magic resigned. They're finally going to speak for the first time a week from today, a week from, you know, this was recording on Monday. They're finally going to speak openly, but until they do, and if they don't answer all of these questions, fans are going to wonder, like, wait. What's the real ownership situation here? What's the real financial situation that the buses are in? Because if they can't afford to put up the capital to make the Lakers as competitive and as dominant financially as they should be, then what are they doing there in the first place?
Right. And then you have the reports coming out that, like, Kurt and Linda Rambis are actually the shadow owners of the Lakers. Just truly amazing. truly an amazing month for the Lakers. But I don't want to dwell on this for too long because they did actually finally hire a coach. They announced it, as you said, we're recording this Monday. It was, like, officially announced it an hour ago. Frank Vogel, head coach, Jason Kidd, one of his assistant coaches. Frank Vogel, of course, was the coach of the Pacers in the early 2010s. He took that team with Paul George, the Eastern Conference Finals 2 years. So LeBron is at least familiar with him through that. He then went to Orlando and had a couple of forgettable seasons, but whatever, it's Orlando. I think you can just throw that out. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on Vogel as the head coach? And then also, you know, the looming little finger, Jason Kidd.
Kittle finger. But so Vogel is aggressively mediocre, I think, as a head coach. He's the definition of fine, if you were to look it up in the basketball dictionary. He's perfectly okay, right? here's the problem. The Lakers told their fan base that he wasn't good enough when they initially opened up the candidate search.
Right.
The fan base knows that they preferred Ty Lue or Monty Williams or even Juwan Howard or even, by the way, Jason Kidd, who they interviewed in that first grouping of interviews the first time around. They open up this other group of interviews. They interview J.B. Bickerstaff. I can't imagine why he was uninspiring. Ryan Hollins was apparently one of the guys that they were interested in, and it was just uninspired choice after uninspired choice, and it made Vogel look okay, right? Which he is. He's mm-hmm. fine. He's okay. It's just that the perception around the hire inspires apathy at best. And then when you combine that with adding Jason Kidd to his roster, that apathy turns to anger because mm-hmm. Kidd probably doesn't belong on an NBA sideline at this point. You know, not just from a basketball standpoint, he left Milwaukee and they immediately yeah. became a title favorite, a title contender, an Eastern yeah. Conference title favorite at the very least, right? That was an immediate impact, and all they added was Brook Lopez. Like, I don't know right. if you're a Brook Lopez stan, but you know, unless you're making Brook Lopez your MVP of the league, the difference there is probably Kidd more than anything. Yeah. So you know, that's not great, and then he's definitely not good enough from a basketball standpoint to get you to overlook his legal problems. Like that, it's right. not even just allegations. It's convictions. It's pleading guilty to beating his wife. It's pleading guilty mm-hmm. to DUI. And I haven't seen all that much contrition from him since on the subject. So, you know, I trust me, I was looking for it. I wrote up the article for Silver Screen and Roll. Like I tried to find mm-hmm. spots where he was contrite and apologized thoroughly for those mistakes. And I wasn't able to find all that much. And so it gets you to a point now where the Lakers are incapable of just making a good hire. The good hire was Ty Lue. They had it right there in front of them. It was right there. hell, Ty Lue was thinking about bringing on Vogel as his lead assistant, right?
Right.
Like, that
right.
was the move. So the only thing people, Lakers fans, who have just been paying attention to headlines at this point, like, imagine not paying as close attention to this, and you go from Frank Vogel's the assistant coach. Oh, yeah, sweet. That's a pretty good hire. I'll take it. To Frank Vogel is now your head coach. Wait, what? What the heck? What? Yeah. What just happened? Right. You know, and yeah, it's hard to feel confident about the direction of this franchise, and we'll see what kind of explanations they offer up, and we'll see also. Like, this is kind of a moment, an important moment for the beat reporters covering this team, because there are some legitimately tough questions that they have to ask of the leadership with the Lakers. And we'll see if they do. We'll see if they do, and we'll see what the answers to those questions are.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I thought the most, like, the grossest point of the whole thing was the report that came out that they were like, they didn't want to hire Kidd because of the legal problems, but they thought him as an assistant coach was acceptable.
Yeah,
that was just icky. That's
also, guess what happens if Vogel doesn't work out?
Right, exactly. And like Vogel has to go into this job expecting to get fired within like by the 2021 trade deadline. Like over under, does he survive that?
I think so, because there's incentive for them to keep him around, right? Like they. Yeah. The front office at this point has taken so many L's. They're basically Tyrion, right? Where right. where their next mistake is going to be their last, you know, to paraphrase from Danny. And I think that's where the front office here is with the Lakers fan base that, by the way, was already out there protesting. Like,
right.
say what you will about the stupidity of a protest and whatever. Like, that's a separate conversation altogether. But the fact is, like, there is that kind of a sentiment out there. And if you listen mm-hmm. to all of the podcasts that were recorded and released the night of and then the day after the Ty Lue debacle, right? Nobody was happy about it. There's no positive right. spin on the situation. So, yeah, if Vogel winds up being not living up to even the minimal promise that he has right now, and then Kidd is his replacement after them distancing themselves, even in this minor way, from his legal troubles, and then he's also a disaster. Then what? Then it, yeah. You know, heads probably should have rolled heading into this offseason, but they didn't. And now they made these calls. Jeannie Buss doubled down on her prioritizing closeness and proximity and trust over, you know, basketball acumen. And you know, whatever happens next and the narrative that comes out of whatever happens next is really all on Jeannie.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I would troll you more about the coaching stuff, but I'm also afraid that if I do, the bad karma is going to come my way, and the Sixers are going to fire Brett Brown, and then you guys are going to be a total afterthought. So I will call a ceasefire at that. But I do want to talk quickly about the Lakers' future,
yeah.
Because, you know, it's obviously a very big summer for them. They get LeBron last year. They have max cap space now this year. They know they can't have another season like they did last year. The draft lottery is tomorrow. They're projected at the number 10 spot, I believe.
Yeah, 10 or 11.
Okay, yeah. Which is not an altogether great chance of moving up, but there is the possibility. Like, if you want the frozen envelope truthers, even though they're using ping pong balls now, someone, you know, hey. If the Lakers win the lottery tomorrow, it's definitely rigged.
I'll freeze some ping pong balls.
Right.
I'll stand in there.
I don't even think that would work. But yeah, sure, go for it, I guess. But you know, this is obviously a big summer, regardless of what happened to the draft, free agency. They're gonna try to go after the big guys. I don't think it's altogether likely that they get, like, it sounds like if Kevin Durant's leaving the Warriors, he's going to the Knicks, regardless of whether that's a good idea or not.
Yeah. Just,
there's too much smoke around that. Kyrie Irving. Do you think that there's any smoke behind that? Like, that, you know, there's talk of him rekindling his relationship with LeBron earlier this year. Would the Lakers even be interested in him with Lonzo there? If they took him or if they signed him, would they dump Lonzo? Or do you think this is all just, like, Laker conjecture because they have max cap space?
I think all of those things can be true. The one thing that I do think is Kyrie and Lonzo could actually work well enough together. Lonzo would have to be, you know, he's going to have to improve on his shot no matter what, right?
Yeah.
Like, at least be a willing shooter. He's a good enough defender to make up for Kyrie and his shortcomings on the defensive side. So I think there are ways that those guys can play together. Look, for whatever reason, and you can take this for what it's worth and take it with a whole heap of salt, but the Lakers seem to think they have a chance at Kawhi Leonard. Maybe they know something that we don't, and you know, maybe Marc Gasol's magical hug will change that at the end of the day. but as of right now, I think, you know, they seem to think that they have a chance at it. And, you know, if that happens, cool. You know, it part of me, even as a Laker fan, would be kind of annoyed if, after all of this bull crap, they are still awarded Kawhi Leonard. Like, yeah. then, like, what's to stop anybody from being nihilistic, right? What's to stop everybody to say, like, okay, so they can literally, like, instead of putting one foot in the other, they've been shooting one foot in front of the other, you know?
Right.
Like, they can make every wrong decision that you can imagine, and it can still yield positive results. That would be really frustrating for me as a fan of another team or as an executive of another team. And I'll still laugh my ass off if it does.
Right, of course. Yeah.
but you know, they seem to think that they have a chance at Kawhi, and then, you know, I forget who it was who put out betting odds on Jimmy Butler's future.
Yeah.
The Lakers are 8-1 on that. I think there's value there to be gained if you wanna make a couple bucks on Jimmy Butler's decision. So, you know, maybe this stuff turns out okay. But as of right now, you know, it's hard for me objectively to say, you know, if I was advising a superstar, yeah, go to the Lakers. That makes sense. Like, it doesn't. there's really no other reason beyond LeBron, and the Lakers seem insistent on pissing off LeBron. So, like, what's the incentive to go to the Lakers? And it's really hard to find it. It's really hard to explain it. It's really hard to objectively look at the situation and say, oh yeah, they have a chance. It I don't really see it.
It is a supporting role in Space Jam 2, like the number two billing next to LeBron.
I,
and then you get, like, a $5 million salary for that?
Well, right. Like, that's the way that they're going to circumvent the the salary cap. Oh, for sure. Cap. Like, LeBron's I will pay you $50 million to be in this film.
Right. There's no way this movie is going to make its money back, but at least the Lakers are going to be good, and whatever. I'll take the L. Just come join me. Save me from my decision, please.
You know how, like, at the beginning, the opening credits, it's like, you know, LeBron James is in this, and then actor X and actor Y and actor Z, and then at the end of it, it's like, and so-and-so, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
That's usually reserved to, like, the oldest actor there, the most prestigious actor there. Like, LeBron's like, I will make you the and actor. I will pay you $50 million. We will circle and highlight your name in the and part. We will give you the monologue of a lifetime. We will win you an Oscar. Just please come save me from this.
Do you think Boban's going to get that treatment for John Wick 3?
I need it. I need it to happen. Like, the five people in each theater who know who Boban is are going to lose their minds if that happens.
I was showing my friends, my wife is a doctor, so all of her friends here are doctors as well. And so, like, one of them is a Philly fan. They've been coming over for the games, and he had no idea Boban was in John Wick 3. So, as we are getting our brains beat in yesterday, I at least got to show him that trailer and got him revived some little bit of hope in his otherwise broken soul, which was nice.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
The other thing I need to ask about, and I hate that I even have to ask it because it is so dumb, but it's been popping up repeatedly lately, is this whole idea of the Lakers trading LeBron James. Mm-hmm. I saw the one idea today. I think it was it Chris Broussard who said LeBron for Ben Simmons? Oh, no, that was Tom Haverstraw, right?
Yeah, so in his article, I just finished writing about it for Silver Screen. And so basically for the Silver Screen website, not for like a Silver Screen production. But but for basically one rival executive of the 76ers. So like an executive from Boston or an executive from Toronto, like some, you know, New York, whatever it is.
100% Danny Ainge.
Yeah, one of the executives that he was talking to said, like, oh, yeah, sure, that could maybe happen, right? Like, it could potential. So it wasn't even reporting that it's even out there. It was just relaying an executive saying that it could possibly happen. And even, you know, to his credit, Haverstraw made that clear in the article, too, saying, mm-hmm. you know, this is not out there yet. This is purely conjecture. This is nothing. This is, as of right now, it's just an option. I just don't see a fit there because, you know the cap situation as well as I do. It'd be really hard. They would have to renounce Tobias Harris. They'd have to renounce Jimmy Butler. They'd have to renounce J.J. Redick. And it would have to be Ben Simmons and very little else so as to fit LeBron into that cap space that would happen if you renounced all those guys. And I don't know. Yes, LeBron and Embiid are a really good tandem, but you know, I don't know if that's the way Philly really wants to build. And then the other thing here too is, all right, so let's say you try to do a sign and trade. I don't really know how that functions in the modern CBA. It's a lot more complicated than it used to be when you could like pull Joe Blow ex NBA player off the streets and sign and trade them to fill in the cap sheet. So I don't really see the fit there. Just in general, though, the way I would explain this idea of trading LeBron, you alluded to the Rambuses, or I like calling him the Rambi. I don't know what it is. It just makes me laugh. But so the Rambi benefit from chaos in the Lakers organization. The more it's the little finger, chaos is a ladder speech all over again. But like, but with Kurt Rambis explaining it in like the dumbest possible way. Right. And so, like, if LeBron gets moved, that's an even larger power vacuum than is already there. Right, Magic Johnson steps away. There's a huge power vacuum that's there that Linda kind of stepped into and is now seen as a shadow owner. If LeBron is gone and his camp is gone and Rich Paul is gone, then that is even more potential power that the Rambi can slip into, right? And and so, you know, when Stephen A. said, you know, a couple days ago that there are people whispering in Jeannie Buss's ear to consider trading LeBron, I'm willing to bet my house on it being the Rambuses or the Rambi, because they benefit mm-hmm. directly from that and the chaos, by the way, that is generated from that rumor getting out there. So anything that seems to throw the Lakers into further turmoil, I think you can kind of chart back to Linda. And that's not, by the way, to completely take blame away from Jeannie Buss. Like, she empowered all these people. She is responsible for the situation in that result in that regard. But, you know, at the end of the day, you gotta trace back to the problems to the foundational problem, and that seems to be where it is.
Yeah. So do you think there's any chance they actually consider trading him, or is this just – should this be a non-starter?
It should be a non-starter. I would put the chances at, like, 5%. I would be – you know, mm-hmm. I would be shocked. I don't know what that – does that make it, like, a 200-to-1 chance, I think, or something like that? Or
sounds right.
Either
yeah.
200 or 2,000
to 1. 20-to-1, maybe?
Yeah, well, like, you win 20. Yeah, so I think it would
oh,
be.
Oh, yeah.
But anywho, but they, I would be shocked, honestly, if they traded him. And it's not from the standpoint of, like, you know, it would be dumb basketball wise. But I don't think the Lakers as a brand could live through that. I don't know if.
Yeah.
For one thing, I know that this front office isn't equipped enough to rebuild the Lakers from the ground the way that they would if they moved LeBron. But also. Mm-hmm. Like, just as a brand, this would be the absolute low point in franchise history. And right. I think I have to hope that they know that. And, you know, if they know that, then they don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Morton and I have gotten into this debate a lot during the year, like way before these rumors ever popped up. And that's what, you know, he was saying from a basketball sense, you could at least make the argument if you don't get a star free agent, LeBron's only getting older, mm-hmm. you could make an argument that it makes sense basketball wise, but I always kept coming back to, like, there is such a PR hit here, yeah. and the Lakers more than most teams are concerned with that.
Yeah,
that you there's just no way you're like you'll burn like clutch will burn you down to the ground.
Yeah, well, also, like, what do the Lakers have to point to? Like, what positive thing do the Lakers have to point to beyond their brand?
Yeah. Kyle Kuzma?
It's like nothing. They have nothing going for them outside of their brand. And if you trade LeBron, that's a major hit to your brand, and thus they cannot risk trading LeBron because that would be risking the only thing that they have going for them.
Right. So before we wrap up here, what do you think is, like, the realistic best-case scenario for the Lakers this summer? Like, obviously, they win the number one pick tomorrow, get Zion, mm-hmm. land KD or Kawhi. That's the dream scenario. But, like, if you're looking back, you know, August 1st, what would you say is a successful offseason for them?
Well, I would still say the bar has to remain pretty high, right? Mm-hmm. Like, so here's how I'll frame it. When Magic Johnson stepped down, they had, I know this for a fact, they had some of the league's top executives doing their homework to see what was going on there, dipping their toe in the water to see what direction they might go in. Because all this stuff said, all this stupidity aside, the Lakers were an intriguing option if you were a Bob Myers, if you were a Masai Ujiri, if you were a Sam Presti, right? They have mm-hmm. They have LeBron, they have a young core, they have a ton of cap space, they have all of the at least theoretical revenue that they have to work with, right? Though that has come into question as of late. But there was there were reasons to point at that and say, okay, yeah, that's a good destination. That's the promotion of all promotions has become PBO of the Lakers. Once they passed up on that opportunity, they lifted expectations on Rob Pelinka to live up to the promise that Bob Myers, that Sam Presti, that Masai Ujiri would have brought with them. So, mm-hmm. you know, it kind of sort of has to be Kawhi. They aren't even in the running, I don't think, for Kevin Durant. I would honestly be surprised if they got a meeting with KD. Mm-hmm. But they, you know, if let's say KD leaves and Klay is seen on the outs in Golden State, you know, there's some thinking because of Klay's dad that maybe the Lakers are in play there. Though even there, like, Michael Thompson has gone out of his way a couple times now to distance the Lakers from Klay Thompson. So that's been kind of interesting. Yeah. But yeah, I would say it kind of sort of has to be a top level free agent. If not that, then you have to open up trade talks again with New Orleans for Anthony Davis. You have to live up to the promise that would have come with Bob Myers or Sam Presti or Musai Ujiri. And if they don't, and they don't fulfill that opportunity cost, again, head should roll.
Yeah. Well, for your sake and for my sake, I hope you do get Kawhi, just because, again, I want him the hell out of the Eastern Conference. I genuinely like LeBron. It would make me sad if the twilight of his career
goes into
500 purgatory. So,
yeah.
As much as I'll troll you on Twitter, I do wish you the best of luck this summer. One more time, let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work.
You can find me on Twitter at Anthony Irwin LA. You can follow at Locked On Lakers. That's the show's thing on there as well. You can read my stuff at Silver Screen and Roll. It's in a dark place. I think only a couple articles, one of my articles ended with bad stuff happens and then we die. So we're in a great place, man.
I can sympathize for the last 24 hours. I know exactly. I went to a meeting today. I'm like, basketball is dumb and I hate it. Why are we covering this sport? So... Yeah, welcome. Or I guess you should be welcoming me to the bad place. I am. Thank you.
Come on in. The water is somewhat fine. It's a little sad, you know. It's like lukewarm water. It's like that spa that's like murky and stuff. That's where we all are.
Yeah. I hope not to stay too long, roughly like 1.5 months, but we'll see. It's going to be a crazy summer for the both of us. So please follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes, so please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews, and we're now being hosted on Spreaker, so check them out on Twitter at Spreaker. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined today by Anthony Irwin. Everyone be nice to him on Twitter. The Lakers have put him through enough.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.